tenderly. Maybe you want to sleep with other people, but I don't want to do that. I can't imagine having sex with someone I don't care about. Maybe we could just take 3 months off, I respond, and use the time to decide what's right in our heart. As I'm making the suggestion, I know she'll never agree to it. If we stop, she responds, if we take a break, that's it. We're done. I will never see you or talk to you again. Her words are loving but firm, not the dithering of an ambivalent. This is it, then. I must make a decision. A lifetime of monogamy with the woman I love, or a lifetime of dating who I want, of doing what I want, of having complete and total freedom. It doesn't mean I'll never have a girlfriend or a child or a family. It just means I'll have them on my terms, not those of this repressive society that expects you to cut off your balls as soon as you say, I do. I'm silent. I can't do it. This is what I've been saying is so natural, yet now I can't bring myself to let go. We have a trip scheduled to Machu Picchu in a couple of months, and countless other adventures we've planned and imagined. I've spent my whole life dreaming of being with someone like Ingrid, someone who I respect, who I trust, who I laugh with constantly, who I wake up next to and look at and just smile, grateful to the universe for bringing someone so lovely and loving into my life. But the silence is more painful than words for her. The tears come now, slowly. You need to go on your quest, she says. And it's one I can't go on with you. You have to go alone. I don't know, I respond. Is this ridiculous? We love each other so much. Are we making a mistake? No, she says. You have to do this for you to be happy. Fortunately, one of us is strong. Do you want to break up? I ask her. No, I'm doing this for you. And that's when I lose it. I hug her, tears drenching our faces. Thank you for teaching me how to love and for teaching me what love is, she says. You have the biggest heart of anyone I know. I don't believe those words, or even see how she can believe them. Yet she does. We cling to each other in silence until she says softly, I wanted to have babies with you. On the ceiling and walls, galaxies are in motion, tiny replicas of planets and stars moving in their own orbits. And I think, we're changing the universe right now. This little decision is going to mean those kids aren't going to be born into this world, and we won't be the parents of cute little sunshine Ingrids and neurotic Neils. A rumbling noise shakes the window, like an earthquake tremor or a violent gust of wind, and I wonder if it's a sign from the universe that we're making a mistake, or maybe it's Mexican sicarios driving up to kill me for working on that book about the drug war. Rick Rubin once told me that on their deathbeds, people don't think about their work or their life experiences or the items remaining on their to-do list. They think about love and family, and I'm throwing it away. I may genuinely be turning that nightmare I had when I was a kid of being a lazy, broke, unloved deadbeat, sleeping on the couch in my brother's perfect suburban family home, into a reality this time. But do I actually want that dream? A house in the suburbs? A domestic routine that never changes? A lifestyle where going out to a movie is some sort of grand adventure? Ungrateful kids like me who blame all their problems on their parents? Maybe my heart isn't as big as Ingrid says it is. Or maybe it's big, but only because it's hungry and constantly trying to consume more so it doesn't starve. I'm on the threshold of the freedom I've been fantasizing about for the last year, yet now it feels like plunging off the edge of that rooftop bar. Ingrid strokes my head reassuringly and says, I feel like I caught a beautiful bird in the wild and put it in a cage just for me to look at. I listen. She knows. She understands me. The cage is near the window, and the bird keeps looking outside and thinking about life out there, and I need to open the cage and let it go because it belongs in the wild. Then her face falls, her eyes redden, and the tears start coming faster. I can't let go, but she can. Between sobs, she sputters her last thought, the six words that will haunt me forever after. But birds die in the wild.
Door 3. Alternatives. Stage 1. Polyamory. You expected not to desire any other men after marriage, and you expected your husband not to desire any other women. Then the desires came, and you were thrown into a panic of self-hatred. Did anyone ever tell you that maybe it had nothing whatever to do with your husband? Erica Jong, Fear of Flying.
Chapter 1. I'm free. I can go wild. I can date any woman I want. I can text anyone, anything, at any time. I can start searching for the ultimate free relationship. But for some reason, that's not what I'm doing. Instead, I'm relaxing in solitude. I didn't even know I'd missed myself. I finished a book last night, and I'm deep into another one this morning. I haven't read this much in years, or enjoyed it quite so much. The bed feels clean and spacious, the sun warm and comforting, the cinnamon toast crunch soulful and decadent. Rick says I'm going to eventually become one of those lonely old men who yell at happy children, but I have my books to read, I have my warm bed, and I have my breakfast cereals. As long as I have these, I will never be alone. Ingrid left with everything she owned in garbage bags 2 nights ago. It was painful. Neither of us could stop crying. She left behind only a ficus plant and a note.
Thank you for letting me see your heart. You always said it was full of darkness, but what I saw was bright and warm, full of life. It's the most beautiful thing. Kind of like walking inside of a cave with a candle and finding this amazing hidden treasure. I think that's why you have the treasure map engraved on you. You told me that your mom gave away your goldfish when you were young because she said you couldn't take care of things. So I'm leaving my plant with you. I call it the survivor because when I got it, it went for months without water and still kept growing. So now it's yours, full of life, to prove you can take care of things.
Her words pierce my most vulnerable organs, my heart and my shame core, which I'm starting to think may be one and the same. Love is so hard to find as it is. It's insane to tell someone to stop loving you for possibly no good reason, especially someone as genuine and caring as Ingrid. But that's what I did. I feel loneliness at times, sadness occasionally, and a hovering sense of doom without Ingrid, as well as guilt for subjecting her to all my doubt, resentment, and struggle for nothing. But still, I'm happier alone. Just me and the survivor. At least the survivor will let me water other plants. I flip the card over to find a postscript. Please do not reply to this and do not call me. I will be trying to heal. If you ever need to reach me in an emergency, your code word is freedom, spelled with 7 E's. You may only use it once, and I will be there for you. I wander into the kitchen to drop my dirty cereal bowl in the sink. I don't clean it. I don't brush my teeth. I didn't even shower or wash my face this morning. I load a surfboard into my Durango and drive to the beach. The sun is blazing. The mountain view is majestic, and the waves are clean. I feel guilty for enjoying it all. Perhaps the people who hurt you the most when they leave are the ones you shouldn't have been with anyway, because they do it without compassion. Ingrid left with nothing but compassion. When I return home, I change into jeans and a thin hoodie. On the kitchen counter, I see Silently Seduced staring me in the face. I flip through it and read some of the passages I underlined. Make a full commitment to stay in your relationship if you judge it to be good for you, Adams writes. Separate the insatiable needs of the inner child from the realistic intimacy needs of the adult. Regrettably, all the developmental needs lost to the incestuous relationship will not be met fully in any one partnership. I panic for a moment, worried that I've made a horrible mistake, that my grounded adolescent has broken up with Ingrid's abandoned child. But then I think that if my needs can't ever be met by one partnership anyway, then I'm definitely doing the right thing by trying to get them met through multiple partnerships. Maybe the damage is irreparable, and I just need to find a way to live with it, to make friends with it, to embrace the shadow rather than fighting it. When the sun sets, I drive to the market to pick up a quarter pound of pulled pork and some coleslaw. As I sit at home, eating out of the plastic containers and watching movie trailers online, I feel a sense of inner peace I can't remember having had in a long time. I can move in any direction I want without anyone stopping me, holding me back, being hurt by it, or even just asking where I'm going or to wait for her. I thought for sure by now I'd be calling someone to spend the night with, just so I could feel a new body pressed against mine and extinguish the solitude. But instead, I'm enjoying being me again. Either I'd lost myself and wasn't really taking care of my needs in the relationship as I thought I was, or it's not actually Ingrid I feel freed from, but the incessant guilt and repression of the sex addiction world. As I lie in bed that night, reading Zorba the Greek, The Backside of the Miller's Wife, That's Human Reason, the eponymous character remarks, my mind keeps turning to Ingrid and replaying things she used to say and do, like the way she used to pull down my pants and yell freedom and try to push me out the door, or the way she'd buy ridiculously flavored drinks like bacon soda or sweet corn soda and present them to me like a ring announcer introducing boxers, or the way she'd try to keep me from entering our bedroom, claiming to be a bouncer and demanding to see my VIP pass. I miss my best friend. I once asked Dave Navarro, a rock guitarist I wrote a book with, why he was sabotaging his marriage to Carmen Electra, who at the time was one of the world's biggest sex symbols. It's like living with my best friend, he complained. And I responded, that sounds great. Who wouldn't want to live with their best friend all their life? Now I know the answer. When you live with your best friend, your dick gets lonely. Linda, a girl I dated in the past, calls. It's as if she has a radar, or more likely is stalking me online. I was Linda's first, and whenever we're between relationships, and occasionally when we're not, we hook up. When I tell her that I broke up with Ingrid, she replies kittenishly, good, now you can have a baby with me. Maybe we can do that someday, I respond, but I don't want to be monogamous. I wonder why I feel like I can't handle marriage, but I can handle fatherhood. I think this is because it's not the responsibility I mind, it's the exclusivity. You can raise a child and still have one or two or 10 other children, and growing apart and separating is the nature of that relationship, so over time, everyone gains more freedom. Linda and I talk about how the arrangement would work in a way that's healthy for the child. But ultimately, it's just a role-playing fantasy. Especially since she has a boyfriend, so I have no idea why she's calling me. All I know is that I don't have to feel guilty for taking the call. I close my eyes and sink back into the comfort of my bed, ready to wake to another limitless day. Free to spread out in whatever direction I choose. Any reality can be mine. I can have a baby with someone like Linda. I can create a free love commune like Father Yod. I can find a relationship that's boundless and limitless. I can be true to myself. And perhaps this is freedom. Standing in a circular room, surrounded by open doors, knowing that I can walk through any one of them, and anticipating the new adventure that lies beyond each one. I may miss Ingrid, but I'm ready. Chapter 2. Entry from Ingrid's journal.
Day 1, 1 p.m. Hercules and I went to the dog park together. I feel weird and strange, sort of shy when talking to guys who approach me. I feel like I'm in a brand new world. So far, I haven't really thought much about Neil, waiting for the night to come. It's the night that scares me. Everyone at the dog park thinks Hercules is a sweetie pie. He mostly keeps to himself and likes to smell the grass. I feel very sensitive. I don't want people to approach me or talk to me. I want to be alone. I feel lonely and sad. 9 p.m. Waiting outside my friend Melissa's house, meeting her for a drink. I need to ask her how she got over her breakup. On my way back to the office from the dog park, I stopped at Rocket Fizz for some fun-flavored sodas. But every flavor reminded me of Neil, because we tried practically every soda there. I found a few new flavors, but then I thought, if it's good, I'd want to share it with him. So I left without buying anything. I miss my best friend, my family, my everything. Can I do this? When is Melissa coming out? God, I've been out here for more than 30 minutes. The moon is shining bright tonight. The moon is caressing me with its gentle light. I hope Neil is outside so the moon can touch us both and connect us with its light. I love him, no doubt. At a bar with Melissa now. She's talking to some guy she knows. He wants to introduce me to the bartender.
Chapter 3. Charles is upset because his wife got mad at him all over again, locked him out of the house, and told his family that he'd cheated on her with prostitutes. Adam has stopped playing soccer, yet his wife still isn't thawing. A haggard rock guitarist named Rod confesses that he's been going to Asian massage parlors behind his wife's back. And everyone is yelling at me. This is my last group therapy session, and Sheila wants them to process my departure. The previous week, they did the same with Calvin, who left the group after deciding to bring Mariana and his son to Los Angeles for a long stay to see if they can make it as a family together. "So what are you going to do now?" Charles asked me, as if life without sex addiction treatment is inconceivable. "What I want to do," I tell him, "is take some time to explore different alternative relationships so I can find the one that's right for me." "What do you mean by alternative relationships?" Adam asks, perplexed. He seems to have no idea that there are options in life besides monogamous marriage. "I wrote down some criteria for the type of relationship I'm looking for," I tell them. I pull out my phone and read a note I jotted the night before. 1. It can't be sexually exclusive, which rules out monogamy. 2. It has to be honest, which rules out adultery. 3. It has to be capable of developing romantic and emotional attachment, which rules out being a permanent bachelor. 4. It has to be capable of evolving into a family with healthy, well-adjusted children, which rules out unstable partners and lifestyles. There's an awkward silence when I finish. Finally, Charles speaks. "I had hope that you'd be the two cars in the garage addict who gets treatment and recovers before he's lost everything." He shakes his head in disappointment. His Alfred Nobel has turned out to be a Robert Oppenheimer. "But now it looks like," he continues, "you're going to have to hit bottom." "You have a sickness in your brain," a construction manager in the group yells, like a priest from the Middle Ages telling me I'm possessed by the devil. He's here because his wife caught him draining their bank account to pay for time with webcam girls. "You're not capable of deciding anything for yourself. Your head got you into this mess, so how do you think that same head is going to get you out of it?" I start to defend myself, but Sheila raises a hand to shush me. "Listen to everyone's feedback first," she instructs. Rod is up next. "Some of my friends have tried open relationships," he begins, "and they don't work. It's natural for you to want one, because you're a male and you're an addict. But no normal woman is going to date you if you tell her you can't be faithful, except someone who's so weak she'll accept that." But who decides what's natural and normal, I wonder? What if it's simply the cultural pressure women constantly receive about being a good girl, saving their virginity, and finding the one, combined with the preponderance of abandoning fathers creating clingy love addicts that people misinterpret as an inherent female disposition toward happily ever after monogamy? I'm starting to believe that the whole notion of classifying certain behaviors as normal and abnormal hurts people more than it helps them. When everyone's finished condemning me, Sheila takes a few deep breaths, her upturned palms rising and falling with each aspiration until she slowed the energy in the room. Then, in as loving a voice as she can muster, she condemns me. You are in relapse right now. What you're doing is making plans to avoid the emotional pain of the breakup and the pain of knowing you can't give Ingrid what she needs in a relationship. I sit there, trying to make sense of what she's saying, but it appears to be complete nonsense. Fortunately, Adam, who seems to be grasping the concept of an alternative relationship, comes to the rescue. Let's face it, what Neil wanted is not what Ingrid's about. He was honest with her, and that's a huge step forward. I don't know if any of us has been that honest with our wives. At least he's figuring all this out before he gets married. Can't you see, Adam, that this is his eroticized rage? Sheila admonishes him. I want to say that using the term eroticized rage as a blanket condemnation of all non-monogamy and casual sex is an act of rage in itself, an attempt to shame anyone who doesn't share her personal views and morals. She could just as easily pathologize my writing, dismiss it as a trauma reaction to feeling misunderstood as a child, and tell me that to be intimate, I need to have two-way communication and go through a 12-step program to stop this solitary form of conversational masturbation. But I keep my mouth shut. Until Sheila gives me permission to respond and say farewell at the end of the session. At first, I want to ask why no one's coming down on Rod for going to massage parlors. But when I look at him slumped pathetically in his chair, I understand the answer. He admits he has a sickness he's powerless over, whereas I still don't believe the sickness exists for most of us, and am about to set off on an exploration of extra-relational sex. So if I don't end up either dead or in some way destroyed, that would threaten everyone's belief in this quasi-religion and thus their tenuous control over their desires. So I fight back my rebuttal, which would only validate Sheila's rage accusation, and simply thank them and tell them to stay in touch. But when she gives me her sad Sheila look and says she's hurting for me, it gets a little harder to stick to the high road. Don't worry about me, I tell her. That's your own pain and sadness you're feeling, not mine. I'm fine. Fucked up, insecure, neurotic, and enlightened. Because I'm done sitting here with these spineless men, most of whom don't even enjoy the marriages they're struggling so hard to save. We've been living in the dark ages of relationships. It was the Catholic Church that began a relentless campaign to make monogamy and lifelong marriages inviolable institutions in the 9th century. It's time to enter an enlightened age of love, sexuality, and attachment. Someone has to undo the padlock that society has put on our genitals, even if it means getting burned at the stake by Sheila, Charles, Joan, Patrick Carnes, and millions of others who are terrified of change, freedom, and ultimately pleasure. So goodbye, sex addiction group. Hello, group sex. Chapter 4. Entry from Ingrid's journal.
Day 4. I always get emotionally abandoned. My dad left, and so does every man in my life. I thought earlier, guys are jerks. Then I corrected myself and thought, well, I picked them, so I'm a jerk. I don't want to be a jerk anymore. I'm so hurt, my heart is numb. Neil doesn't want me, and he's probably happy he's not with me. I try to forget so it doesn't hurt, one day at a time. Tomorrow is another day with a little less pain. I'll be okay. There's a light that follows me and always makes sure I'm okay. Neil forgot me this soon? I haven't forgotten him. I don't want him to know he hurt me. He let me go.
Chapter 5. I told you I was the villain in the story. Chapter 6. Beer cans and plastic bags crunch under the tires as I park near the address Shama Helena gave me. Rows of mismatched homes line the street, each with its own dying lawn. The more affluent residents are distinguishable by low metal gates separating their property from their neighbors. The house I'm looking for is a one-story yellow stucco affair. Behind it, there's a garage and a garden shed, each leased as an apartment. I am here to see the tenant living in the garage. It's not the best neighborhood in the valley, and I'm not sure if I'm doing the right thing by coming here, but I have to start somewhere. So why not with Shama Helena? The first place I started looking for monogamy alternatives after my last group therapy session was the online polyamory community. Where polygamy historically refers to someone married to multiple people simultaneously, polyandry if it's a woman with multiple men, polygyny if it's a man with multiple women, polyamory is a more recent and much more broad term, meaning many loves. It was coined in the early 90s by Morning Glory Zell Ravenheart, a New Age writer whose name pretty much embodies the post-hippiness of the original poly community. Her neologism spread quickly because, among other reasons, it's far more graceful than saying pluralistic relationships or multiple partner relating. While searching online for local polyamory meetup groups, I stumbled across Shama Helena's name. In addition to leading one of the groups, she also self-published a book called Polyamory 101, and she coaches newcomers to the alternative relationship world. So I contacted her to discuss my options and the best places to find open-minded partners. I knocked softly on the door of Shama Helena's garage, excited to begin my journey into the world of alternative relationships and find my non-monogamous one, or ones. Evidently, judging by her place of business, teaching people to have more lovers doesn't pay as well as teaching them to have fewer. Shama Helena greets me in loose-fitting drawstring pants and a tank top with massive cleavage thrusting out of it. She appears to be in her 50s, with auburn hair, long bangs, and a compellingly witchy face, but with a nose that's broad rather than sharp. Common sense tells me to leave. Curiosity drives me forward. The garage has been converted into two rooms. The busty witch of the Central Valley leads me to the back one, in which a bed has been squeezed lengthwise between the walls. She sits cross-legged at the head of the mattress. This is her office. Apparently, I'm supposed to sit opposite her at the foot of the bed. I wonder what kind of woman would let a stranger who contacted her off the internet into her home and onto her bed within seconds. Then I realize that's exactly the kind of woman I've come here looking for. In the 16th century, a woman like Shama Helena would probably have been burned at the stake. Not necessarily because of the way she looks, or the candles, incense, and red draperies strewn throughout the house, but because women who were overtly sexual were thought to be witches possessed by the devil. We've come a long way as a culture in 500 years. Now, instead of calling them witches and killing them, we call them sluts and kill their reputations. Men have a conflicted relationship with female sexuality. When a man is single, he wants women to be as easy and undiscerning as porn stars. But at the same time, he's terrified by this behavior because he thinks if a woman sleeps with him so easily, then clearly she'll sleep with anybody and thus won't be faithful in a relationship. We have so many contradictory, repressive, self-limiting beliefs about sexuality, and almost every one of them stems from a pathological need to dictate to someone else what they are and aren't allowed to do with their body and heart. So what can I help you with? Shama Helena asks. I start to tell her my story, but as I'm talking, something starts to collapse inside me. I pause and close my eyes to strengthen the walls of my heart, and Shama Helena, the all-seeing, catches me. What's wrong? She asks. I suck in a lungful of incense-laden air. I was thinking about Ingrid, my ex, I tell her. It feels weird to call her my ex, as if she's been crossed out of my life. We booked this trip to Machu Picchu together, and I just got sad thinking of going without her. in a slow voice that's a little too breathy, as if she's studied Marilyn Monroe singing Happy Birthday to John F. Kennedy. She tells me that she believes there are three types of men. Till death do us part guys, who want to be with one person for the rest of their lives. Peter Pan types, who never want to grow up and just want to accumulate notches on their belt. And mature men, who want to have intimate relationships with multiple partners. As I listen to her, feeling like a combination of all three types, I start imagining what her sex life must be like. I see her naked, wrinkles everywhere, tits hanging down her chest, and with a huge radiant smile, being groped by guys with gray chest hair and with torsos like an expanse of hills. For some reason, the scene isn't disgusting. It seems joyful. Shama Helena rises and walks to a hot plate on a shelf a few feet away, presumably her kitchen, to pour a cup of tea for herself. She offers me some, but I worry that it might have an aphrodisiac in it, so I pass. When she returns to the bed, presumably her dining table as well, I ask about the most common types of polyamory. From her long response, I manage to piece together these three relationship structures. 1. Having a primary partner, with each person free to negotiate or enter into separate secondary and tertiary relationships. 2. Creating a triad, in which three people are romantically involved. This can take the form of three people in an equal relationship, a triangle, one person simultaneously dating two others who are not as close to each other, a V, or a couple sharing the same secondary, which she doesn't name, but I suppose would be a T. 3. Forming a group relationship of four or more people. Where would swinging fall into this? I ask. She grimaces like she's just tongued down a bleeding hemorrhoid. The swinger lifestyle is just let's fuck, she says. The poly lifestyle is I'd like to get to know you. I suppose if polyamory were all about sex, it would be called polycoitus instead. In the lecture that follows, Shama Helena explains that to most people, polyamory means having multiple loving, romantic relationships in which all the partners know about one another. The key word here is loving. A relationship that permits only casual sex on the side wouldn't technically qualify. The other distinction is honesty. Having a secret mistress or being in a don't-ask, don't-tell relationship wouldn't truly be polyamorous either. And poly doesn't necessarily come with freedom. Many relationships, Shama Helena explains, require sexual exclusivity to some or all members of the group, or as it's called, polyfidelity. Whatever the situation may be, she tells me, what you want is a bonded partnership that gives you a foundation to fly. There's a concept called compersion, and that means if your partner has another lover, rather than being jealous, you're happy for her because she's happy. Suddenly, reality sinks in. If I can do what I want, then of course whoever I date should likewise be free to do what she wants. And how am I going to feel if I'm home alone working while she's spending the night at some lover's house or a long weekend at a 5-star tropical resort with some dashing Romeo trained in the arts of the Kama Sutra? Traditionally, adultery has been a privilege chiefly reserved for men. Anthropologist Gwen Brode researched 112 different societies and found that 56% permitted extramarital sex for husbands, whereas only 12% allowed it for women. Even in the Bible, and in societies today where they bury people up to their necks and stone them to death, it's typically adulterous women, and often their lovers, who are punished, rarely married men who cheat with single women. However, liberation for only one person in a relationship isn't truly freedom. It's totalitarianism. So I'll have to learn to let go and suck it up. What if compersion isn't an emotion that comes naturally to me? I ask. Like anything, it takes work, Shama Helena responds, arching her back. Despite her witchiness, the display arouses me. The incense must be going to my head. Good thing I didn't drink the tea. In order to truly be polyamorous, you're going to have to go through the path of uncomfortability. Just know that you're going to experience jealousy, and know that it's about you. So allow yourself to be vulnerable. Don't be afraid to show your feelings and needs and work through them. In the end, you'll find that true love is wanting your partner to have whatever she wants, whether or not you approve of it. I inhale cautiously. It's excellent advice, and I think I can do this. I imagine Ingrid having sex with someone else, and I guess as long as I knew I was her primary, I could eventually learn to deal with whatever feelings came up. Maybe it would even inspire me to be better in bed instead of being lazy and fantasizing about other women. There are just 3 minutes left in the session, and I have two burning questions I still need help with. In my most challenging times with Ingrid, an image kept coming back to me. The picture of Father Yod, living with all his happy hippie lovers. So I ask, what if I want to create a community of people living together in a single, open relationship? I win big points with Shama Helena for this question. It's her dream also. She says she wants to get some property and have everyone in her tribe live there in different houses. I try to imagine her renting all the garages in the neighborhood. Question 2, how do I know which type of relationship is right for me? I ask her. She recommends dipping my toe in the water by going to the annual World Polyamory Association Conference, which she describes as the biggest and most established event in the community. Take your time before deciding what relationship style is right for you, she adds. First, explore the different options this world has to offer. See some good modeling and see some bad modeling. Stay on the outside and be in a place of inquiry, but notice what you gravitate toward. As we wrap up our session, I feel energized and optimistic, with a better grasp on how to move forward and what to look for. However, as I slide off the bed and make my way out of her lair, Shama Helena slowly raises her hand and points a crooked finger at me. One more thing. The breathiness is gone. Her voice is stern. I worry for a moment that she's going to turn me into a toad or a dildo or something. You need to be upfront with everyone you meet, because if you date a monogamous woman, she's going to want to be in a monogamous relationship. It's not fair to her. So if you're serious about this, I want you to promise me you won't have any monogamous partners. That massively narrows the playing field. It would rule out all of my past partners, not to mention most of the population of North America. However, if that crazy cannibal in Germany could find someone willing to be eaten alive, I can at least find a few women who will let me date other people. So, I promise, I tell her. Good, she replies. You need to find someone in the paradigm. For example, I'm a tantrika, and I don't date anyone who's not tantric. So she is a witch, I think, as I give her $50 for, as she puts it, an offering. I've never trusted people who mix spirituality with business, and I'm not sure if Shama Helena is an exception to that rule, but for my first small venture into the world of polyamory, it wasn't too bad. I'm looking forward to taking her advice and, for starters, searching the World Polyamory Association Conference for potential new partners. As I walk out and make my way back down the path, Shama Helena asks when I'm going to Machu Picchu. Next month, I tell her, imagining all the fit poly yoga women I'll be meeting at the conference, younger versions of Shama Helena. But then she calls out after me, let me know if you have any ET experiences in Peru. And something inside me plummets. I think it's hope. Perhaps Rod's right. Expecting to find sane women in this community may be unrealistic. They're like benevolent extraterrestrials, guardian angels, and Norse gods. Imaginary creatures, products of fantasy, symptoms of a longing not to be alone in the universe. Chapter 7. Entry from Ingrid's journal.
Day 7. I feel much better.
Chapter 8. At home the next day, I register for the World Polyamory Association Conference, which falls on the same dates I was supposed to be in Peru, so I push the trip back. Then I order a stack of books from Amazon, the classics in the field of consensual non-monogamy. The Ethical Slut, Opening Up, Sex at Dawn, Polyamory, The New Love Without Limits, as well as a lesser-known book from a more therapeutic perspective, Love in Abundance, A Counselor's Advice on Open Relationships, by Kathy Labriola. I speak with her briefly, and she explains that she believes multiple partner relating is as fixed a sexual orientation as being straight or gay. Since I have a month until the polyamory conference, I do something that I've been repressing for the last year. I re-engage with the women who are texting and emailing during my relationship with Ingrid. Even though Ingrid and I are no longer dating, I still feel like I'm somehow betraying her. Unfortunately, my first dating experiences go too well. I take a trip to spend time with Radney, the augmented Las Vegan who emailed after I returned from rehab. But after just two nights together, she asks, "Are you sleeping with anyone else?" It's evident from her tone of voice that this is not an innocent question, but an ultimatum. So I very clearly and compassionately explain to her, "When I hear your question, it sounds like you believe that an experience with someone else would detract from whatever we're developing together. But wouldn't it be better to just allow this relationship to set its own course without trying to control it or limit each other? Sexual exclusivity shouldn't be a criteria for deciding whether to care about someone or not." Radney listens closely, blinking her false eyelashes, taking in every word and weighing its meaning carefully. Then she responds bluntly, "I'm not that kind of girl." Right monogamous apple, wrong orchard. A week later, Elizabeth, the entrepreneur who wanted to distract me on Skype when I was dating Ingrid, invites me to a business dinner she's having with investors. Afterward, we end up making out in her apartment. She sucks my finger into her mouth, then reaches down my pants. Suddenly, however, she disentangles herself and says, "I'm so attracted to you, but I have a son, and if I have sex with you, you have to marry me." Her words shock me, as if sex is something to barter with in exchange for commitment, as if love is a business agreement to be negotiated and notarized, as if her pussy is a fucking startup and my dick is the angel investor who's going to fund it. Even more shocking, she's already in a long-term relationship with a high-profile lawyer. Maybe she's planning to jump ship. There's a term called hypergamy, which is when people marry someone of higher status. So I suppose this would be hypogamy. As I drive home dispirited, I realize I've already made my first mistakes. Monogamous relationships are waiting in the shallow end of the dating world like fishing nets. Just one wrong move and I'll get tangled up again. And to break up with Ingrid just to end up in another exclusive relationship would not only be a travesty, but neither Elizabeth nor Radney, despite all their positive attributes, has even a fraction of the quality of heart, sense of humor, or joy of life that Ingrid has. Shama Helena was right. You can't just date people randomly and then hope to slowly ease them into a non-monogamous relationship. You have to be upfront from the beginning. I spend the rest of the week looking through my options and eliminating everyone who's monogamous, already dating someone, or clearly not relationship material, leaving three strong possibilities. There's Violet, a bisexual writer with whom I've had many sexual adventures, but when I call her, she tells me she's currently experimenting with monogamy. There's Anne, the French woman who emailed nude photos while I was with Ingrid. She's a healer and acupuncturist, and her social media posts suggest an alternative lifestyle. So I start talking to her and eventually make plans to visit after the polyamory conference. And then there's Belle, the Australian coquette who kept texting while I was with Ingrid. When I met Belle, I brought her and a cute skater girl back to my hotel room to spend the night. So she's clearly non-monogamous. "Remember that night?" I ask when I call her. She giggles. She remembers. After a little small talk, I continue. "I don't know if you're familiar with polyamory, but it's the idea that love is not some kind of scarce resource that can only flow into a single person. I pause and wait for a well-reasoned objection or verbal tirade. When she says nothing, I elaborate, babbling nervously. Just as a person can love parents, children, pets, and all kinds of songs and movies at the same time, so too can they love different partners, without the emotions for one detracting from the emotions for the other. So I'm... Finally, she speaks, mercifully interrupting me. You want to put together a harem, don't you, Mr. Strauss? I hadn't quite thought of it that way. I think Father Yod lived with men and women, each with their own husbands and wives. But who doesn't want a harem? And there's a lilt to Belle's voice. It's flirtatious, and she hasn't hung up or said I'm a monster. These are good signs. The last thing I want, however, is some kind of cult or patriarchal Mormon household. So I explain. A harem to me is a bunch of women controlled by a guy. I'd rather live in a group atmosphere of learning and growth where everyone's equal and free. Who are these other women you want to live with? Suddenly the lilt changes to a sharp, suspicious minor key. Behind every yes, there's always a no waiting to ruin all the fun. I don't know yet, I tell her. But if you are interested in maybe joining me on this exploration, I'll make sure they're cool people we'd both get along with. Somehow, the word exploration seems safer than relationship. Less commitment, easier for her to back out of. And we don't really know each other all that well yet. But at least I'm being upfront this time. I'm not sure what you're up to, Mr. Strauss, but I trust it will be interesting. The lilt is back. That wasn't too difficult. If I can just get a few more women to say yes, I'm going to be living a fantasy that as an adolescent, I didn't even dream was possible. I thought it would take years to put together something like Father Yod's group relationship. How soon can you get here? I ask. I have some time off in 3 months, she replies. I'll see you then. Now I'm committed, and in over my head already. Fortunately, I have time to learn to swim. The World Polyamory Association conference is happening soon, and there I can find not just the tools to make this work, but like-minded people with knowledge, experience, and hopefully an interest in joining me. Because if monogamy isn't natural, and cheating isn't moral, then the people there must be the bravest, most ethical, and most enlightened beings in the relationship world. Chapter 9. My name is Sasha, he says. Then he strips naked and runs around the interior of a circle of men. Afterward, the guys standing there, most of them gray-haired, loose-skinned, and pale, strip off their ill-fitting clothing and traipse into the center. There are man tits, saggy asses, and swinging penises everywhere. The only person still wearing clothes, holding fast as the last representative of the collapsed circle, is me. I thought the World Polyamory Association Conference was going to be a well-organized networking, lecture, and workshop event that would teach me about managing non-monogamous relationships and living with multiple partners. Instead, I'm in a latter-day hippie nudist resort called Harbin Hot Springs, surrounded by excessively happy naked men whom I can't imagine functioning effectively in the outside world. That said, at least they're free. Really, really free. To kick off the conference, we separated into a men's circle and a women's circle. Then each attendee was asked to introduce himself and make a gesture for everyone else to imitate. One guy twirled, another waved, I bowed, and good old Sasha, an energetic 70-year-old with an infectious grin and deep-set smile lines, just had to strip naked. Sasha also happens to be one of the founders of the World Polyamory Association, along with his wife, Janet, who later explains that polyamory was a gift given to our civilization by aliens from the planet Nibiru. I'm reminded fretfully of Shama Helena's parting words. Is the idea of polyamory so far out that only people who believe in aliens can grok it? Perhaps the connection comes from the classic science fiction book, Stranger in a Strange Land, in which a man born on Mars comes to Earth and starts a free love cult. Author Robert A. Heinlein wrote in 1961, "The code says, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. The result? Reluctant chastity, adultery, jealousy, bitterness, blows, and sometimes murder, broken homes, and twisted children. There is no need for you to covet my wife. Love her. There's no limit to her love." After the welcome circle, a gray-haired woman with an extremely soft voice, they seem to think here that speaking quietly means being spiritual, leads the group through an exercise in which we create an energy field around ourselves, and a partner tries to sense it and walk into it. So far, none of this appears to have anything to do with polyamory. "Do you need a partner?" a voice booms. I look up and see a tall, naked, bearded man hovering over me. He seems creepy. In fact, there's nothing a naked guy could say to me right now that wouldn't seem creepy, especially when he looks like a pot-bellied Abraham Lincoln. I take a step back and tell him I'm passing on this one. I find an inconspicuous spot against the wall and press myself against it. Nearby, a large middle-aged woman is lying on her stomach, gravity flattening her excess deposits against the carpet. An extremely pale man-child with curly hair, who appears to be 20 years her junior and 120 pounds her inferior, lies beside her in a toga, his package dangling outside the sheet as he massages the meat of her shoulders. The Pollies end the morning session by performing a contact dance. They roll around the floor like logs, crossing, colliding, and touching, touching, touching. I'm not sure I'd want to do this, even with people I was attracted to. I broke up with Ingrid for this? So far, the conference seems more like bisexual new age softcore swinging than polyamory. When Sasha announces a lunch break, I dash to the buffet. I figure if I'm first in the food line, no one's pubic hair will end up in my veggie burger. I load my plate, then find a seat at an outdoor picnic bench. Just next to it, there's a hot tub in which a smiling nude woman is floating on her back, rapturously exposing herself to the sun's rays. Naked Abraham Lincoln sits next to me and strikes up a conversation. He tells me he was recently widowed. It seems odd that the first thing he does after she dies is go to a polyamory conference to play log jam with a bunch of strangers. But then again, that's what I did as soon as Ingrid and I broke up. He is the future me. We're soon joined by a couple who introduce themselves as Martin and Diana. Martin is a tan, muscular painter from France. His wife, Diana, is a Latin woman with enormous natural breasts. She says she wishes her husband wasn't poly, but she accepts it and has her own secondary. However, she adds, shooting him a look, I'd give it all up in a second if my husband decided to be monogamous. A shy couple from Sacramento sits next to them. The man wants to open up, but his wife has reservations. These relationships sound like the exact opposite of the marriages in rehab. Instead of a wife expecting monogamy from a husband who doesn't like it, the man is expecting non-monogamy from a woman not comfortable with it. Perhaps the women here are simply less stubborn versions of Ingrid, the men more strong-minded versions of me. I wonder how a wife would cheat in this inverse relationship, by not sleeping with anyone else? Lincoln tells me that this used to be a big conference with nearly 200 attendees, but one of the main volunteers stepped down. She had three lovers and was in danger of losing custody of her children because of her lifestyle, so she had to start acting more monogamous. His story is disheartening. If anyone who has more than one partner is seen by the government as immoral and unsuitable as a parent, then this revolution has much bigger enemies to fight than the sex addiction industry. We're interrupted by a naked rabbi who lives on a poly kibbutz in Israel and is in some way dating the woman who's either sleeping, dead, or meditating in the hot tub. He stands up, pours a glass of wine, and sings a prayer over it in a deep, beautiful voice as his dick swings in the air like a metronome. It is in these moments that I miss Ingrid most. Loneliness is holding in a joke because you have no one to share it with. After lunch, we return to the conference area. A few more attendees have arrived, and I scan them, hoping to find a woman I'm attracted to. But even with my low standards, I see only one person, a short, curvy blonde nerd with thick black glasses. The next speaker, a relationship coach with long silver hair named Scott Katamas, teaches something called the Four Adjustments. To make relationships healthy and harmonious, he tells the assembled polys, it's necessary to 1. Turn judgment into compassion and acceptance. 2. Transform shame into reassurance. 3. Change criticism to appreciation. 4. Replace blame with understanding. It's the first piece of useful information I've gotten here so far, and reminiscent of the principles of functional adult behavior that Lorraine taught in rehab. Later, I notice a group of polys sitting in a circle and passing a talking stick, discussing being their authentic selves and yelling, "Aho!" Maybe all these people are also sex addiction rehab refugees. Just when I'm about to dismiss the conference as a waste of time, a pack of 8 people burst through the door. They're comparatively young, they're generally fit, they're reasonably attractive, and they're clustered around a rail-thin woman like she's their father Yod. She has an angular face and a bob haircut. From one vantage point, she looks cute. From another, she looks severe. From yet another, she looks like a man. "Who's that?" I ask Honest Abe. "That's Kamala Devi. She's really big. She has a 4,000-person mailing list," he says with awe. Kamala walks to the front of the room and greets the admiring throng with a namaste, pressing her palms together and holding them over her head and then her heart as her admiring pod gathers around her. Everyone I've met so far came here either alone or as a couple. This group of men without shirts and women in half tops and yoga pants is actually the first poly constellation I've seen so far. And unlike the couples I had lunch with, the woman is in charge and clearly into it. Kamala stands with perfect yoga poise in front of the room, her hair parted high off her forehead, her skin so taut that every contour of her skull seems visible. She begins her talk by leading conference attendees in a chant of Om. Afterward, she introduces herself as a goddess and presents her poly family, which appears to consist of her husband, her female lover, another married couple, the male lover of the woman in the married couple, and 2 floating fringe lovers. It's hard to follow. Serial monogamy alone has given us a complicated landscape of fractured and blended families. A world of polyfamilies expanding and splintering would be a bureaucratic nightmare. Maybe that's one reason polygamy is illegal. Otherwise, some enterprising rogue could marry hordes of foreign women, get them U.S. citizenships, and claim thousands of tax exemptions. As Kamala speaks, her pod sits intertwined with her and one another in a massive display of poly PDA. Minus the freaky New Age talk, their lifestyle looks like a lot of fun. In concluding her lecture, Kamala says that in order to make a group this large work, she has to be a benevolent dictator and, at times, a controlling bitch. I wonder if that's the secret to polyamory, a yin-yang of wimpy spirituality and repressive fascism. I hope not. Shama Helena advised me to observe from the outside and notice what I gravitate toward. So that night, I gravitate toward Kamala's pod, scouring the retreat until I find 3 of her menfolk sitting in the resort's nudity-mandatory hot tub with a nerdy girl. One is Kamala's husband, Michael. Another is one of her married lovers, Tal. And the third is one of their orbiting lovers. "We're having a special party in our room later," the orbiter tells the nerdy girl. "You can come watch, or participate, if you want." I slip into the hot tub and strike up a conversation with them. Michael tells me that he originally met Kamala at a puja in San Diego over a decade ago. A puja is a Hindu ritual in which worshippers honor and commune with a deity. And from what I gather, the Pallis have turned it into an erotic guided meditation and dance party. Tal tells me his wife initially had no interest in polyamory. So in order to open the marriage, he encouraged her to date other people while he remained faithful. After letting her enjoy this freedom for a year or so, he gradually started dating as well, which is when he met Kamala, who convinced the couple to move in with her. His words are a revelation. When I was with Ingrid, I was hoping for my sexual liberation. But a far better way to encourage a partner to open a relationship is to start by giving her the freedom that you want for yourself. I ask the Orbiter what his story is. Squeezing Tal on the shoulder, he answers, "We dated each other, but we're not gay." "How is that possible?" I ask. "The new young poly scene is largely bisexual," Michael explains. "Everyone in our pod is bi, except for me. I'm just bisensual." This is the future of free love. No barriers whatsoever to sexuality, including age, body type, and gender. As the podmates talk about a reality show they're working on and a polyamory hotel they want to build, a voice suddenly bellows over the water. "You guys ready?" I look up and see a yoga stud from Kamala's pod. "Have you rounded up any more girls?" the Orbiter asks him. Kamala Devi and Shama Helena said polyamory was about loving relationships, not casual sex. But these guys seem more like next-level pickup artists, coming to these conferences with the intention of sucking any available women into their powerful reality. Although I suppose if you're a spiritually evolved super being, you exist in a constant state of love, so there's no such thing as casual sex. If you love everyone, all sex is polyamory. "No, but you're gonna miss the birthday spanking if you don't hurry up. Kamala's waiting." The guys leave the tub, taking the nerdy girl with them. "If you want to really learn more, you should come to this event we're putting on called Tantra Palooza," Michael says on the way out, offering me a consolation prize. "It's sex everywhere with everyone." I watch them leave, impressed that they've created not just their own alternative relationship, but their own alternative reality. They're taking dating to a whole new level. Why go to bars or comb online profiles to meet women? Just put together sexually themed hotels and festivals, and they'll flock to you in the hundreds. If you build it, they will come. Chapter 10. The following night, 36 men and women, with body parts falling out of colorful sarongs, shawls, togas, and wraps, gather in the conference room, anxious for what's about to transpire. This will be my first puja. "I have an announcement to make," a gray-haired woman named Evelina Rose says beforehand. The brochures on the welcome table identify her as a practitioner of multidimensional healing, soul retrieval, and addiction recovery. Some of the women have complained that in the pujas, the gentlemen were getting competitive and aggressive for the ladies. Please respect appropriate boundaries in the pujas. She hands the microphone to Katamas, who begins by urging everyone to dance freely and let go of their inhibitions. From what I've seen, I'm not sure what inhibitions he could possibly be referring to. He then instructs us to sit in a circle and make eye contact with one another. I look into old eyes that are sad, joyful, restless, scared, and scary, and into the uniformly youthful and bright eyes of everyone in Kamala's pod. Feel Mother Earth below you and Father Sky above, and allow them to meet in your heart and flow love through your veins, Katamas continues. When he asks us to touch our hearts and rock back and forth, breathing deeply to inhale the light, I start to lose myself in the moment, to relax and suspend judgment, to feel connected to everyone else breathing and swaying in the room. Then suddenly, I hear Kamala Devi's unmistakable voice on the microphone. "Remember that you're just 3 breaths away from orgasm," she says. And unexpectedly, I start laughing. Her words are a complete non sequitur, awkwardly thrown in to remind everyone that sex is still on tonight's menu. Evelina Rose shoots me a nasty look, like I'm ruining the puja. So I shut my mouth to contain the laughter, and it starts to escape through my nose. Just as I'm beginning to get a grip on myself again, Kamala declares that she's stepping in as the priestess of the room, and I lose it again. I suppose laughter is just my way of managing the discomfort I'm feeling. "I'd like you now to touch the source of your sacred energy and make a connection with it," Kamala intones. I place my palm over my heart, but everyone else lays a hand over their junk. Clearly they know something I don't. I move my hand to my sacred crotch and look at the diverse Pollies, their hunger for one another growing through this spiritual foreplay. And my crotch tells me, "Please, Neil, don't do this to me. I don't want any of these people touching me." So I tell my crotch, "Listen, you're the one who wanted free love. You're the one who thought the image of Shama Helena frolicking naked was beautiful. Well, this is it. You've arrived. It's no time to start acting like a snob, caught up with superficial things. We've left that world. We must love all people." "Like that wart-covered Amazon over there?" my crotch responds fearfully. "And that sweet, wrinkly septuagenarian from the planet Nibiru? And even that naked, widowed Abraham Lincoln?" Sigh. My crotch and I are out. I slip away from the circle, sit in my safe spot against the wall, and try to make myself inconspicuous as Kamala plucks the unspoken desire out of the air and continues transitioning a room full of strangers into a room full of fornicators. 1 minute, everyone's on the floor doing the logjam. The next, the men are hugging one another bisensually. Soon, a very randy, black-haired, hair-shaped 50-something Tantrika is throwing her arms into the air and moaning loudly. My stomach rumbles hungrily. I was so concerned about making sure I saw the puja tonight that I didn't have dinner. "Now walk around the room and allow yourself to gaze at and appreciate the feet you see," Kamala instructs. "If you want, you may ask for permission to touch your foot to someone else's." She goes on, telling them to look at and touch a succession of increasingly intimate body parts, like a naughty hokey pokey. From the safety of the wall, it's an enjoyable show. As Tal takes the black-haired Tantrika's hand in his and spins her around in a blissful ballroom dance, I wish I could be as free as he is, able to celebrate the joy and beauty that's in everyone. But even if everyone in the room looked like a supermodel, I'd still be too weirded out to join in. I need to take this opportunity to figure out why that is. I tiptoe to the buffet table to forage for food, but all that remains is a bag of organic olive oil popcorn. Technically, popcorn is an air-infused vegetable, and olives are a fruit, so it's not all that unhealthy a meal, and the package does say organic, so I grab it and return to my perch. "Now gaze downward at each other's lingams and yonis," Kamala is saying. The men and women wander through the room, staring lovingly at one another's crotches as Kamala reminds them, "Appreciate the beauty of her sacred cathedral." The oldest men start to cluster hungrily near the youngest women, as if it's a game of musical chairs, and when Kamala stops talking, they'll all get to feel up the closest body. So far, pujas seem like the ultimate form of intimacy for intimacy avoidance. For some of these men, it's a way to experience love and connection without attachment or commitment. For some of the women, a way to have random sexual encounters without feeling dirty, used, or unsafe. In theory, this should be paradise for the sex addict that Rick thinks I am. So why am I so uncomfortable? Why is the guy who wanted sexual freedom so badly sitting against the wall feeling so limited? I reach into the popcorn bag and grab a handful of dinner. The crinkle of the packaging reaches Kamala's ears, and she focuses in on the sound like a cat. She slinks toward me, crouches until her face is just inches from mine, and hisses, "This is a temple. We don't eat in the temple." "Sorry, I didn't know this was a temple." I try to say it sincerely, but it comes out sarcastically. And maybe that's because I'm totally confused. When exactly did they turn this generic conference room into a holy sanctuary? And if it's just make-believe time, then why can't my popcorn be the temple's equivalent of a communion wafer? And how does she know it's not sacred popcorn, anointed in the oil of a virgin olive? But I say nothing. I kiss the bag tenderly and quietly place it at the feet of the benevolent priestess. Goodbye, popcorn. Our puja together has ended. We were just 3 kernels away from orgasm. Kamala walks away and instructs the Pollys to form groups of 4, select a person to be spoiled, and give him or her a 3-way massage. I still have a few pieces of popcorn in my fist, so I put them where they belong, in my mouth. It is not a dietary necessity, but a minor act of rebellion, the vestige of a male ego that doesn't really belong here. I am a food thief in the temple. In a flash, Kamala is crouching in front of me again, her face a little too close to mine. I told you once not to eat here, she whispers staccato, the veins on her thin neck bulging angrily. You need to take that food out of here and eat it in the kitchen. I stand up grudgingly, and she watches as I return the popcorn to its rightful resting place on the buffet altar. I grab another handful to satiate my hunger, and... who am I kidding? I'm not taking the food because I'm hungry. I'm taking it because I hate irrational, restrictive, unnecessary rules. That's the reason I left Ingrid and the world of monogamy in the first place. And now I'm in a world where the rules are even more irrational and more ridiculous. Kamala is not a good priestess for enmeshed men. I hear her voice ringing through the metaphorical temple. If you like someone's wand and want to touch it, don't be shy. When I return from the kitchen, nearly everyone's wraps have dropped to the ground, flaccid wands and